Welcome to Speak Up, Speak Out, progressive voices from around the valley and around the nation, conversing about issues important to our community.
Good evening and welcome to Speak Up, Speak Out Radio 91.7 FM KSVR on the Skagit Valley College campus. I'm Jody Buller. With me this evening is the West Coast editor of Organic Gardening Magazine and author of the popular Seattle blog DigginFood.com. She also has a weekly radio show on KUOW called Green Days. Willie Galloway is here. She came to town for a free talk at the Mount Vernon Public Library and agreed to join us in the studio. Willie, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks. It's my pleasure.
So the subtitle of your blog, I just love. I'm not sure if it's a subtitle when it's a blog, but it's Grow, Cook, Eat, which about sums it up. Can you tell us how you got started writing this and what you're writing about lately?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I chose Grow, Cook, Eat as my tagline. I think that would be what you would call it, because I think really that's what vegetable gardening is all about. If you're growing vegetables, you're not just growing them to look at, you're growing them to eat. And if you're eating vegetables, clearly you're cooking with them as well. And so I thought that just sort of, you know, wrapped everything that I wanted to do on the blog together. And I really started it as a personal project. You know, I work as an editor at Organic Gardening, but like any job, I am assigned things that I have to work on, and I really just wanted to have a place where I could write about what I'm most passionate about, and that is cooking from the garden. So on the blog, I really cover, you know, projects for the vegetable gardening, recipes, right now I've been talking about varieties a lot since I'm planning my garden for 2010.
So you're thinking fairly seasonally with it as well.
Yeah, I update it about four times a week. And so that, everything I'm talking about is really seasonal. And the recipes throughout the year are really reflective of what's coming out of my garden at that time.
Well, reading it made me both hungry and inspired. It was really a fun visit. So it sounds like you have a garden. Do you have current favorite vegetables?
Sure. You know, I have a vegetable garden and I'm actually in the process of planning how to expand it. So I have five raised beds in my side yard now, and I also grow food in my front yard and a little bit in other spots in my backyard, and I'm looking to expand to put in about five more raised beds. And I grow blueberries and strawberries, raspberries I actually have raspberries in containers, which lots of times people don't realize you can do that. Favorite vegetables, I have tons. in terms of what you can plant around this time of year, something I always put into the ground is heirloom lettuce from Germany. It's called Forellenschluss.
Wow.
You can also often find it under its American translation, which is less pretty. It's the flashy troutback lettuce. And it is really, though, it's a great lettuce. It's a romaine type lettuce, and it has, if you allow it to grow to its head size, it has really crunchy base of the leaves, and then the top parts are just succulent and sweet. It's so good. Mm-hmm. You can also grow it as a cut and come again. So that's really one of my very favorite salad greens.
Yeah. Do you have a sort of a way of introducing new foods? Do you get to know? I get to know one vegetable at a time, sort of in season, and see how many different things how many different recipes I can work it into.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's the thing when you have a garden, right? Like, I mean, when it's tomato season, it's tomatoes, and you're eating them three times a day. And you know, we often have tomatoes in the morning for breakfast on toast, and that's a really nice, I think, thing about vegetable gardening and eating seasonally is, you know, at the end of tomato season, I'm a little bit done with tomatoes. I'm ready for winter squash. It's, you know, it's a bounty, but, you know, then I'm ready to move on to something new. And so now as at the end of winter, I'm really looking forward to sort of just fresh, tender greens. I have chard and kale in my garden, and I've eaten them, you know, 5 million different ways. My favorite way to eat kale currently is to saute it with some garlic, throw in a can of white beans that's been drained and rinsed, and just cook that up till it's warm, and then toss that with pasta and lemon zest, and it's just...
Oh.
Yeah, it's okay. So good, so fast, so easy. Mustard greens are great, collard greens. Those are all good cooking greens, Swiss chard, kale, beet greens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with all greens, they can, most of them can be eaten at different stages. And depending when you harvest them is how you prepare them. So when they're small and young and tender, they're fine to eat raw in salads or sandwiches even. But as they get older and bigger, typically they're a little tougher, and so you need to cook them so the heat softens them up a little bit and also can mellow out some of their stronger flavors.
That makes great sense. I just recently had collard greens, which are one of those kind of toughies, prepared as a wrap instead of bread for a sandwich, and it was amazing. What do you have any good techniques for how to soften collard greens without just cooking the heck out of them?
Oh, sure. So that's a great point. A lot of these big leaves can make a great wrapper. I often use Swiss chard when I have leftover risotto. I stuff the Swiss chard with risotto, and what I do is I just what's called blanch the leaves. So you bring a big pot of boiling water, and then you put the leaves in, and you just leave them in there for, 30 seconds. And then you take them out with tongs. And what I do then is I lay the leaf out in front of me so that the stem is, pointed towards me, and the leaf tip is away from me. And I cut out the, an inch or two of the thick part of the stem. And so then I'm left with kind of an arrow-shaped leaf. There's a notch. And you put the filling, whatever you're going to put there, so risotto or, rice pilaf, whatever you want right there.
A nut pate would be really good in that, too.
Yeah, and so, if you eat meat sausage that's been mixed in with rice or something, put that right above the notch. And then you fold the leaf notches over that, and then you can roll it up kind of like a burrito, and it keeps everything in a nice little pouch. And you can use that with Savoy cabbage leaves, the collard greens, anything like that. Those all make a really nice, my husband calls it vegetable as a vessel. So, anytime you can use the vegetable as the vessel to your mouth is a good idea. So stuffed peppers, stuffed tomatoes, stuffed zucchini, stuffed leaves of the greens. Those are all good vegetable vessels.
And also good ways of having fun with your food. This is one aspect of food which is very much a personal act. This, the time spent in the garden, the time spent preparing food for yourself and your family and your friends. Do you see growing your own food also as a political act?
I think it depends on the gardener. I think gardening is certainly a form of self-expression. And so if you choose to take a part of your yard out and grow food in it, I think that that's showing that you value your food and you value the earth that it comes from and you're invested in your food. And so certainly growing food can be a political act. I think where gardening and politics intersect more is when people work to make sure that everyone has access to gardening education and also a place to grow food. And so in Seattle, I served for many years on the board of Seattle Tilth, which is an organization that teaches people to grow organic food, and it is also now working in underserved communities to ensure access to food, to places to grow food, and also the skill, because gardening is a skill. It's not something you just know how to do. It's something that's taught and that can be passed on to people. And so I think that's where, if you really do have a political interest in our food system, working to make sure that everyone has access to a place to garden is a good way to do that.
That makes great sense, and it brings to mind some of what Will Allen was speaking about. He came to Seattle last month to talk at Mercer Middle School, and he spoke about food justice and urban agriculture, and it was a very interesting presentation. He's the 2008 recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, and he works as the co-founder and president of something called Growing Power, which seemed to me to be a working urban agricultural model. So he's doing it in Milwaukee where he lives, and there are other Rust Belt cities with a lot of vacant space downtown. And Growing Power is working to do vertical agriculture to help inner city communities, which are sometimes, well, very frequently food deserts, places where the only place you really have to buy food is the convenience store on the corner, and there's no live food in there. So how to teach those skills both and provide that space. He was talking about how Growing Power made 20 million pounds of compost last year, which sort of blew me away. What can you speak a little bit about what's so important about compost and good soil? He really felt that was kind of foundational to the work they were doing.
Oh, sure. You know, I cannot emphasize enough how important soil is. If you think about it, that's where it's your plant's home. So that's where they get all their nutrients, all their water, all their oxygen is from the soil. And so ensuring that you have healthy soil is the best way to ensure that you're going to have healthy plants. Not to mention, when you look at soil, there's a lot that doesn't meet the eye. So there is a whole ecosystem of microorganisms and insects and worms and other creatures that live in the soil. And they all have a very symbiotic relationship with plants. So there's, you know, fungi and bacteria and protozoa, all sorts of things. And, you know, a lot of times when you talk about microorganisms, the first thing people think of is disease. Mm-hmm. And for sure, there are certainly pathogenic organisms in soil. But by and large, most of them have this, you know, symbiotic relationship with plants. So mycorrhizae, I'm never quite sure if I say that right, but
that's the plural. Yeah.
they're a fungi, and they help plants' roots sort of extend out into the soil and scavenge for more nutrients. And legumes, so beans, peas, favas, they have a symbiotic relationship with rhizobia bacteria. And so if you've ever grown peas and pull them out of the soil and you see little knobs on the roots, it's not a cause for concern. That's actually something that's good. And those bacteria, they take some carbohydrates and other nutrients from the plant's roots. And in exchange, what they do is they take atmospheric nitrogen, which there's loads of in the air, but it's not available to plants because it's not a form that plants can use. So they take that atmospheric nitrogen and they fix it down into the soil in a form that the legumes can use. And so in conjunction with the rhizobia bacteria, legumes are actually able to kind of manufacture their own nitrogen. And so they're a great crop to plant after a heavy feeding crop like squash or tomatoes, because they'll actually help add nitrogen back into the soil. But back to your question about compost, the reason compost is such a great amendment for soil is that soil is made up of minerals, about, you know, 92 to 95% minerals. And that's why different soil looks different in different parts of the country. So the Southwest has a lot of iron in the soil, so it can be really red from oxidation. And then the other part of soil is organic matter. And so that's this, when anything living dies, it breaks down into humus, which is organic matter. And that's where all the action is. That's where all the life in soil is in the organic matter. So compost is a source of organic matter, and it's where your microbes are living. It also has a lot of nutrients in it, so it releases nutrients slowly to your plants because the microbes continue to break down that organic matter, and the nutrients that are in that organic matter, they do what's called mineralize them, and they turn them into forms that plants can use. So compost is really great, not to mention that it's a way that you can recycle material that's in your garden on site right back into your soil, because your plants, it's kind of like a bank if you think about it. Plants are taking stuff up out of the soil, out of the bank, and then if you just pull those plants and put them in your yard waste bin, you're sending all that money off-site. But if you turn that into compost and put it back into your garden, you're recycling those nutrients back out of the soil that they came from. So it's a nice way also to reduce your waste stream as well.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. This is Jody Buller, Speak Up, Speak Out Radio, KSVR 91.7 FM on the Skagit Valley College campus. We're talking this evening with Willie Galloway, who is the West Coast editor for Organic Gardening Magazine, and she is giving a talk on grocery gardening, veggie gardening on a budget. And we thought we would try and pick her brain while she was in town for some good information as spring kicks into high gear here. Willie, what do aspiring gardeners need to be thinking about during these next few months?
I think if you are just becoming a new gardener, first you want to think about where you're going to garden. So all vegetables need at least 6 hours of sunlight in order to thrive. So it's important that you choose a spot that is going to fulfill that for your vegetables. And then I think the next most important thing to do is think about what you like to eat. You might as well grow stuff you like to eat. So I like pretty much every vegetable, so I grow lots of different things. But, you know, crowd pleasers are always potatoes, garlic, and a lot of times people don't realize how easy garlic is to grow. I find people who've been growing vegetables for a year who don't grow garlic, and it's really one of the easiest things to do. You plant it in the fall, and then you harvest it in the next summer, and that's about it. There's not a lot involved with growing garlic. So, yeah, just growing what you like to eat. There's still plenty of time to get seed orders in, seed companies, seed catalogs. Those all have such a huge range of varieties that you might not find at a nursery. So it's fun to either order their catalogs or look through those websites and try something new, you know, try a red or a purple carrot or a yellow one instead of just an orange one, or, you know, try a lettuce that's really speckled, or just, you know, try something new and different, because if you're growing it, you're going to be investing your time and your energy, and so it might as well be something that's fun and pleasurable to eat.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Keeping the creative juices going, I guess. Also, speckled lettuce will do that for you. Any good ideas about how to be successful in transplanting if you're starting up, if you're starting things from seed, how to introduce them into your garden space?
Sure. So, you know, you have two choices. You can start some plants by seed, or seed, you know, starting seedlings indoors, or you can grow plants directly by seed out in the garden. And they both have their advantages. So if you're growing directly by seed, you know, it's usually cheaper than buying transplants, or if you're starting your own transplants, it's certainly easier if you're just planting the seed outside. And some plants just do better if they're planted outdoors. Beets, dill, beans, carrots, those are all things that you should just go ahead and sow outdoors. Don't try and start seedlings indoors. If you're starting seedlings indoors, Organic Gardening actually has a great tutorial on how to do that. It's a little step-by-step slideshow. It shows you exactly what you need to do. But when you're taking those seedlings outdoors, and sometimes too if you've bought seedlings at a nursery, you need to do what's called hardening off. And the idea there is that these seedlings have been growing in your nice, cozy, warm house or in a greenhouse, and then if you subject them to the cold, cruel world, they just don't do so well right away. So you want to expose them to that gently. So you take the plants and you set them outside in a shady, sheltered location for a couple hours, and then bring them inside. And then the next day, you put them out for a little bit longer. And over the course of a week, you gradually increase the amount of sun and wind and that they get, and the time that they spend outside, until you can leave them outside overnight. So that's what hardening off is. Then if you are planting seedlings out in your garden, what I always do is 24 hours before I want to plant them, I water them. And then again, 2 hours before I plant them, I water them again. And so what I'm doing is I'm ensuring that that plant's fully hydrated. I also try to plant in the afternoon or evening, because then, you know, your plant, they have a pretty small root system. You're taking them out of their pot. You're putting them in the soil. It's a little bit of a stressful experience. And if you do that in the morning and it's a hot day or it's a windy day, you know, you're just going to be exposing them to a lot of desiccating factors. They can lose a lot of water. So doing planting them out in the afternoon minimizes the stress to the plant. And then I always water them in with a weak fish emulsion, which is an organic fertilizer. And it does smell like fish, it's true. But that goes away as soon as it's dry. So those are kind of my tips for for transplanting.
What about ideas for how to help heat-loving plants that may not be prone to thriving in our Pacific Northwest's harvest season? Any ways to trick them into thinking that they're growing closer to the equator?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, the Pacific Northwest is a fabulous place to garden, especially if you like kale, because it's cool here. But you know, if you want to grow warm season crops, melon, peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers, squash, those are all plants that are native to South America and Southeast Asia. So those places are warm during the day, they're warm at night, which is really important, and they have warm soil. So the first thing you should do is choose varieties that are bred to do well in cooler climates. So with tomatoes, I often look to tomatoes that were bred in Russia or in the Pacific Northwest. Oregon State University has a big breeding program. So Legend, Oregon Spring, a lot of the black tomatoes, black crim, Japanese black trifle, those are all tomatoes that are shorter season. Anything, you know, that is going to mature in under 80 days. And the seed packet or the catalog or the plant tag should tell you how many days it'll mature. You'll see that information on there. So choose shorter season. Anything, you know, 85 days tops, but really under 80 days is better. And look for what, you know, ones that say they're shorter season or that they mature well in cool climates. Any type of information like that is good. Also, I always heat up my soil before I plant my plants. I don't like to use a lot of plastic in my garden, but in this instance, I think it's warranted. And so plants, especially peppers and eggplants, if you put them in cold soil, if you, you know, plant them out in early May when the soil is still cool, they will just sit there and they will be stunted. And if you plant plants in June, they'll grow a lot faster than those ones that you got out there early. So I usually wait to plant my warm season crops till the end of May. And while I'm waiting, I heat up the soil. So I stretch clear plastic over a seed bed that's been raked smooth and watered, because water will help take the solar energy that gets trapped from the plastic, and then I'll take that down in the soil, warm up the soil. It can warm it up 15, 20 degrees. Oh. And you want your plants, all those crops like to be planted in soil that's over 60 degrees, ideally 70 degrees. So waiting to plant and then heating up the soil prior can really help. Growing them under a cloche, so a little hoop house or a little glass cloche or a plastic cloche, that gives them a little extra heat, especially at night. There's little things called wall of waters. They're these little plastic teepees that are filled with water, and those, you know, release heat out into the air at night. Those can all help. Anything, you know, give them your warmest, sunniest spot. Eggplants and melons are especially hard to grow, but they do, some of the smaller melons especially, will do okay in containers. We trellis them. So then you can put them, you know, on a southwest-facing wall. That's the hottest, you know, it's going to get reflective heat. It's the hottest area of your yard. So just kind of try and give them as much heat as possible, and don't plant them too early.
What about for people considering chickens or goats or other sort of animals? Any good ideas or resources, places for people to check out if they're beginning the chicken walk?
Sure. I have 4 chickens, and one thing to really keep in mind with chickens is that they can be very destructive in gardens, and it's just their nature. They scratch. They're from, you know, they come from South America, and they were sort of digesters on the forest floor, and they scratch and they look around. And so my biggest advice for chickens is to build a coop and a run that is big enough that they can be in there most of the time. And then they can have supervised forays out into the yard. But ours, due to just miscalculations on our part, free range all the time, and they cause a huge mess. And so it's frustrating. But they are wonderful pets, and they eat tons of kitchen scraps and insects, and they provide beautiful eggs. So they're certainly worth having, but it's something to keep in mind. I don't know a lot of resources up here in Skagit Valley, but Seattle Tilth has great classes on chickens as well as goats and honeybees. So those are some some resources, and then there's lots of books out there, on, especially on chicken keeping. But the main things, you know, you need enough. You should provide them with plenty of space. They need dry, clean bedding, fresh water every day, exercise, entertainment, and you don't want them to be crowded because then you get into, you know, pecking order issues and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Well, that's some great baseline information. It sounds like the grocery gardening is based on a lot of these sort of fundamental ideas about how to maximize the space that you have. Any other thoughts you have about veggie gardening on a budget that would be helpful?
Just really, I would encourage people to look to their community. And so, you know, you can buy seed in bulk from Territorial Seed Company, Johnny's Seed Savers Exchange. And when you buy seed in bulk, you can then, it's cheaper and you can divide it among friends. If you don't have a tool, ask your neighbor and, you know, share with them. Host a seed exchange, share plants, offer to help someone divide their perennials in exchange for getting to take some home with you. And really looking to your community can make gardening more enjoyable and also more cost effective.
Yeah, that makes great sense. Lily, thank you so much for being here this evening. Any website resources or other things you want to share with us? Can you tell us where we can hear you on KUOW?
Yeah, I speak on the radio on KUOW every Tuesday. You can download the podcast or stream that. And also on my website, diginfood.com, I'm always posting new information about vegetable gardening and how to use those vegetables in your kitchen once you harvest them.
Fantastic. Well, this is timely and great information. I noticed on your blog a post about Hunger Action Week. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and what your experience with it was like?
Sure. King County, in United Way of King County, asked me to participate in Hunger Action Week, which was a hunger awareness week. And basically, my husband and I were asked to purchase food with only the maximum food stamp budget, which is $63 for the whole week. Well, for 5 days and 15 meals. And so, you know, what I found to be the biggest challenge is I realized how much I actually eat from my garden, and that wasn't allowed. You couldn't use any pantry items or food from your garden. You were assuming that, you know, just the food stamp budget. And so, you know, it was a challenge to eat healthily and stay within the budget. And also, my biggest mistake that I made is that I bought food with, I was under the budget, but all the food that I chose to make that week was pretty time consuming. And, you know, it was a busy week for me. And I have to say, I didn't completely stick to the budget because, you know, one night we just really didn't have time to cook the risotto that I had planned on making. We ended up having to have sandwiches that we had, you know, from our house. And it just made me realize that how resourceful people who are only living on a food stamp budget need to be in order to feed their families healthily, and how critical it is that people need to know how to cook, and also that gardens can be a huge supplement for a family's budget. And so we really do in our communities need to make sure that people have access to healthy food and not forget that having vegetable gardens is one piece of that puzzle.
Very much so. Lily, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Yep. My name is Jody Buller. This is Speak Up, Speak Out Radio, KSVR 91.7 FM. Thanks for supporting your local public radio. Have a good night.
Join us each week for Speak Up, Speak Out. Archives are at speakupspeakoutradio.org. Theme music courtesy of Kurt Crandall. Until next time, seek peace, work for justice, celebrate diversity, and support your neighbors.
This program was produced in the studios of KSVR-FM by the Speak Up, Speak Out Collective. Distribution was made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.